on human psychology 80 years ago. So, and some term, I mean, this is, they've been studying these people long term since, closely since the 60s, because they revisited these people after they still had their contact information. So, makes a strong case for that kind of engagement. So, we're moving on to Susan Pinker, who's a Montrealer. You probably know her brother. I'm going to cut in a little bit on this one because some of the data that she's putting out, some recent findings have kind of pushed back on some of the items that they're bringing up, but still interesting. She makes some interesting points, so I'm still going to bring it up. Without further ado, we'll play this little snippet by Susan Pinker.
Over 100 taught me how to make the local specialty, which are these large pasta pockets, like ravioli about this size, and they're filled with high-fat ricotta and mint and drenched in tomato sauce. And she showed me how to make just the right crimp so they wouldn't open. And she makes them with her daughters every Sunday and distributes them by the dozens to neighbors and friends. And that's when I discovered a low-fat, gluten-free diet is not what it takes to live to 100 in the Blue Zone. Now, these centenarian stories, along with the science that underpins them, prompted me to ask myself some questions, too, such as, when am I going to die, and how can I put that day off? And as you will see, the answer is not what we expect. Julianne Holt-Lunstead is a researcher at Brigham Young University, and she addressed this very question in a series of studies of tens of thousands of middle-aged people, much like this audience here. And she looked at every aspect of their lifestyle, their diet, their exercise, their marital status, how often they went to the doctor, whether they smoked or drank, etc. She recorded all of this, and then she and her colleagues sat tight and waited for 7 years to see who would still be breathing. And of the people left standing, what reduced their chances of dying the most? That was her question. So let's now look at her data in summary, going from the least powerful predictor to the strongest, okay? So clean air, which is great, it doesn't predict how long you will live. Whether you have your hypertension treated is good, still not a strong predictor. Whether you're lean or overweight, you can stop feeling guilty about this because it's only in third place. How much exercise you get is next, still only a moderate predictor. Whether you've had a cardiac event and you're in rehab and exercising, getting higher now. Whether you've had a flu vaccine, did anybody here know that having a flu vaccine protects you more than doing exercise? Whether you were drinking and quit, or whether you're a moderate drinker, whether you don't smoke, or if you did, whether you quit. And getting towards the top predictors are two features of your social life. First, your close relationships. These are the people that you can call on for a loan if you need money suddenly, who will call the doctor if you're not feeling well, or who will take you to the hospital, or who will sit with you if you're having an existential crisis, if you're in despair. Those people, that little clutch of people, are a strong predictor, if you have them, of how long you'll live. And then something that surprised me, something that's called social integration. This means how much you interact with people as you move through your day. How many people do you talk to? And these mean both your weak and your strong bonds. So not just the people you're really close to who mean a lot to you, but like, do you talk to the guy who every day makes you your coffee? Do you talk to the postman? Do you talk to the woman who walks by your house every day with her dog? Do you play bridge or poker or have a book club? Those interactions are one of the strongest predictors of how long you live. Now, this leads me to the next question. If we now spend more time online, than on any other activity, including sleeping. We're now up to 11 hours a day, 1 hour more than last year, by the way. Does it make a difference? Why distinguish between interacting in person and interacting via social media? Is it the same thing as being there if you're in contact constantly with your kids through text, for example? Well, the short answer to the question is no, it's not the same thing. Face-to-face contact releases a whole cascade of neurotransmitters. And like a vaccine, they protect you now in the present and well into the future. So simply making eye contact with somebody, shaking hands, giving somebody a high five is enough to release oxytocin, which increases your level of trust, and it lowers your cortisol levels. So it lowers your stress. And dopamine is generated, which gives us a little high, and it kills pain. It's like a naturally produced morphine. Now, all of this passes under our conscious radar, which is why we conflate online activity with the real thing. But we do have evidence now, fresh evidence, that there is a difference. So let's look at some of the neuroscience. Elizabeth Redkay, a neuroscientist at the University of Maryland, tried to map the difference between what goes on in our brains when we interact in person versus when we're watching something that's static. And what she did is she compared the brain function of two groups of people, those interacting live with her or with one of her research associates in a dynamic conversation, and she compared that to the brain activity of people who were watching her talk about the same subject but in a canned video, like on YouTube. So, and by the way, if you want to know how she fit two people in an MRI scanner at the same time, talk to me later. So, what's the difference? This is your brain on real social interaction. What you're seeing is the difference in brain activity between interacting in person and taking in static content. In orange, you see the brain areas that are associated with attention, social intelligence, that means anticipating what somebody else is thinking and feeling and planning, and emotional reward. And these areas become much more engaged when we're interacting with a live partner. Now, these richer brain signatures might be why recruiters from Fortune 500 companies evaluating candidates thought that the candidates were smarter when they heard their voices, compared to when they just read their pitches in a text, for example, or an email or a letter. Now, our voices and body language convey a rich signal. It shows that we're thinking, feeling, sentient human beings who are much more than an algorithm. Now, this research by Nicholas Epley at the University of Chicago Business School is quite amazing because it tells us a simple thing. If somebody hears your voice, they think you're smarter. I mean, that's quite a simple thing. Now, to return to the beginning, why do women live longer than men? And one major reason is that women are more likely to prioritize and groom their face-to-face relationships over their lifespans. Fresh evidence shows that these in-person friendships create a biological force field against disease and decline. And it's not just true of humans, but their primate relations are primate relations as well. Anthropologist Joan Silk's work shows that female baboons who have a core of female friends show lower levels of stress via their cortisol levels, they live longer, and they have more surviving offspring. At least three stable relationships. That was the magic number. Think about it. I hope you guys have three. The power of such face-to-face contact is really why there are the lowest rates of dementia among people who are socially engaged. It's why women who have breast cancer are four times more likely to survive their disease than loners are. Why men who've had a stroke who meet regularly to play poker or to have coffee or to play old-timers hockey, I'm Canadian after all, are better protected by that social contact than they are by medication. Why men who've had a stroke who meet regularly, this is something very powerful they can do. This face-to-face contact provides stunning benefits. Yet now almost a quarter of the population says they have no one to talk to. We can do something about this. Like Sardinian villagers, it's a biological imperative to know we belong. And not just the women among us. building in-person interaction into our cities, into our workplaces, into our agendas, bolsters the immune system, sends feel-good hormones surging through the bloodstream and brain, and helps us live longer. I call this building your village, and building it and sustaining it is a matter of life and death.
So that was just Susan Pinker, who is lives just north of us in Montreal, and our brothers, I believe, Steven Pinker, Better Angels of Our Nature, a great book worth checking out. He's also a Harvard professor. So I did cut off a little bit of the beginning of that talk, and just one little pushback about Blue Zone longevity rates. Some recent studies have pushed back with the data on some of the Blue Zone's longevity. And I believe a lot of it, of the data, is wrong because of people mislabeling their birth dates in those areas. And they're often very rural, isolated communities. So just that side note. But there's other data that kind of really backs up how social engagement can increase the longevity and happiness of your life and decrease your chance of dying, because who wants to die? I don't, that's for sure. So we're moving on to David Thoreau, and this is going to be a longer segment. I'll probably going to have to cut it off a little bit early for our public service announcement. Basically, it's going to go into his life, and it's also a very interesting snippet of history. Around the 1840s, there was a big... This is when our democracy was extremely young, and there was a lot of people concerned about our democracy. Was it going to survive? This is basically an experiment of representative democracy of this size. So there was a big push to get people more engaged in their communities, starting the Lyceum, which is going to be the hopeful namesake of the radio program that I'm coming out with. But the Lyceum is a public venue where people can debate social issues and education about some of the new science and poetry and just where you can meet your neighbors, get some information, engage with ideas that were happening, including during this time, 1840s, it was the very beginnings of the abolitionist movement in Henry David Thoreau's community, with these speakers that came and talked with their life experiences that kind of really set off this movement in the States and also worldwide. So this will be coming up in the snippet. This is about an hour long, 7 minutes long, of snippets of Henry David Thoreau's life. As always, you can call 656-4399 if you have any comments you want to add to this or anything at all. So let's get into it. Like I said, this is going to be about an hour long. I might cut in from time to time to comment about the stuff that we're listening to. Or if you want to make any comments about the stuff we're listening to, you can always call in, like I said, 656-4399. So without further ado, basically this first segment is Henry David Thoreau in the very beginning of his life. Him meeting, hanging out with his brother, playing quote-unquote Indian, as they called it back then, and events that kind of really pushed him into his life as a writer, influential writer and poet. So let's get into it.
One Sunday evening, late in September 1837, something Henry Thoreau couldn't get out of his head. For a month, it teased him, until finally he wrote it down in his new journal. Was it worth recording? Maybe. He tried it out. After spending the day looking for Indian relics, he and his brother John strolled to the riverbank to watch the sunset. Henry, seized by inspiration and gesturing wildly, broke into an extravagant eulogy on those times. There on Neshotok, said I, was their lodge, the rendezvous of the tribe, and yonder, on Clamshell Hill, their feasting ground. How often the Indians must have stood on that very spot, at that very hour, just like John and Henry, watching the sunset over the Muscataquid River, communing with the spirits of their fathers gone before them. Here, I exclaimed, stood Tahatawan, and there, to complete the period, is Tahatawan's arrowhead. Down they sat, and Henry, to carry out the joke, threw out his hand to seize a random stone, and lo, it proved a most perfect arrowhead, as sharp as if just from the hands of the Indian fabricator. It's a light-hearted story, just two brothers playing Indian. But when Henry's hand grasped something real, his youthful fantasy caught hold of an adult truth. The arrowhead, hard and sharp, didn't feel like a relic from the past, but like a live thing handed to him by an elder, as if Tahatawan himself had materialized at his elbow and offered him a choice. You may laugh this off as superstition, or you may take it up as truth. In the act of committing this story to his journal, Henry made a choice. He would make it true. This choice will set him off from family, friends, and neighbors. Unlike them, Henry David Thoreau would be a writer. This meant taking up the writer's double consciousness, splitting the self who lives from the self who writes, opening up a double vision, present and past, man and nature. Jumping that gap had been the point of the joke to begin with, the kind of play-acting that usually ends when childhood is over. But Thoreau, fingering in the nick of time the stone blade's edge, felt that gap snap shut. Time folded together, and for an instant, he straddled both sides, beholding two realities in one. He wasn't quite there yet on that Sunday, watching the sunset from the riverbank. He came closer a month later when he opened his journal to answer Emerson's call. "What are you doing now?" he asked. "Do you keep a journal?" "So I make my first entry today." There, he's begun. Nature to Thoreau began as a family, communal event. Dr. Josiah Bartlett, the village physician, often led neighborhood children on swimming and fishing expeditions, and on summer afternoons, young men and women got up walking parties to climb Fairhaven Hill or stroll around Walden Pond. Cynthia and John, renowned for taking long walks together, fit right in. Rumor had it that one of their children was nearly born on Neshawtuk Hill. A neighbor recalled how Cynthia set off on grand picnics, cooking supper on an open fire and boiling water in a little tin teapot, and leading them all home by twilight. Cynthia, with her keen delight in nature, trained her children's eyes and ears. She would take them outside and make them listen to the birds. Framing little verses of exclamation, cheerful or plaintive, to fit the accent of the outbursts from the various little feathered throats. Soon, the boys were out on their own, when John and Henry came running into the house, slamming the doors. Cynthia reminisced, "I knew that Ben Hosmer or Joseph had come, and that the boys would take their luncheon and not be home till night, being off for Walden, Fairhaven Cliffs, Egg Rock, or down the river." Decades later, when Horace Hosmer saw Henry and Sophia ramble out together, he with his notebook, she with her sketchpad, he thought, they were father and mother over again. Nature and art lovers, son like the mother, daughter like the father. Concord's town planners believed education was a civic necessity for everyone, not just the wealthy. Phineas Allen took an important step in October 1828, when he founded the Concord Academic Debating Society to give his male academy students practice in forensics. The thrust and parry of political government, the foundation of civic democracy. Academy debaters crossed swords over such questions as whether gunpowder was a benefit to humankind or whether America would always be free. A month after its founding, John Thoreau, Jr. was debating the question, are good novels preferable to good histories? The Academy lads must have wanted out from under Allen's governance, however, for in January 1830 they started a new debating club of their own, the Young Men's Society for Mutual Improvement. But far more exciting was the new Concord Lyceum, which became one of the organizing centers of Thoreau's life. The Lyceum movement had been founded by Josiah Holbrook. Electrified by a lecture on chemistry and geology, the Massachusetts schoolmaster envisioned an America where all working men, nay, all citizens, could be inspired by knowledge of science, nay, knowledge of all things, the arts and letters and history as well, all that was useful that could be linked to everyday life. After Holbrook published his manifesto in October 1826, he led his movement with the fervor of a crusader. Lyceums would be local associations for mutual, hands-on instruction, where citizens would speak to one another of what they knew, sharing local knowledge and community resources, and linking to nearby communities for support and exchange of speakers across growing networks, all toward raising the moral and intellectual taste of our countrymen. After founding the first lyceum in the industrial town of Millbury, near Worcester, in November 1826, Holbrook traveled from town to town, organizing new ones wherever he touched down, until his lyceum movement reached right across the nation. Only a week after, this Johnny Appleseed of the Lyceum came to Concord in October 1828, the Concord Debating Club, the adult model for Allen's student version, took up the question of founding a lyceum in Concord and decided in the affirmative. On December 3rd, a large crowd of Concord citizens voted unanimously to make the Concord Lyceum a reality. A month later, the newspaper was proclaiming its pride that Concord, whose ancestry were among the foremost and boldest ancestors of civil and political liberty, would stand among the first to emancipate its citizens from vice and ignorance. For $2 a year, half that for those who had to travel from farther away, every town citizen could bring two ladies, and if married, his children in addition, to weekly meetings that alternated lectures with debates. The fees covered expenses for out-of-town speakers, plus a cabinet of minerals, scientific apparatus, and a library, all made available, by the way of Lyceum Secretary Phineas Allen, to the students of the Concord Academy, and to the town's public school students, too, providing their teachers paid the dues. Since Allen's students were all eligible to attend Lyceum events, Thoreau's lifetime membership may be said to have begun at the age of 11. Soon, the town was assembling at the Concord Academy to hear weekly debates on such politically charged questions as whether the state should build a railroad from Boston to Albany. Yes. Whether corporal punishment in the schools should be abolished. No. And whether it was right to move Indian tribes from their ancestral lands to regions beyond the Mississippi. No decision. Lyceum lectures consistently drew a full house, eager to learn about geography and history, politics, theology, and the sciences. In 1829, a course of lectures on chemistry attracted an audience of 100. For decades, the Concord Lyceum was one of the largest and most active in the nation. Thoreau attended regularly and took several turns as curator and secretary, which allowed him to direct the town's attention to topics he thought were important, such as the abolition of slavery. He lectured there himself nearly 20 times in as many years, testing out his ideas before a live audience who, having seen him grow up from boyhood, were unawed by his growing fame and freely expressed their amusement, skepticism, and often their appreciation. Civil disobedience was born at the Concord Lyceum. So were Walden, the Maine Woods, Cape Cod, and the late natural history essays. The importance of the Lyceum to Thoreau is incalculable. It bound him to the town, and bound the town to him. Whenever Thoreau wrote for the wider public, the faces he saw in his mind's eye were those of his friends and neighbors. To all this, the Thoreau household was integral. John's pencil business was important to Concord's commercial success, and Phineas Allen, who taught three of the Thoreau children, joined the household for a time. But the family's involvement went beyond this. The Thoreaus often hosted, and always attended, the lively parties held for Academy students and their families. They were regulars at the Lyceum, often escorting the speakers and putting them up for the night. And their household was growing. After Grandmother Jones died in 1830, the colorful Uncle Charles and the round and loving Aunt Louisa moved in to stay for the rest of their lives. Cynthia always had the final say over who could board at her home, and she made sure her boarders were people of quality who could educate her children in the newest ideas sweeping the nation, and who added to the intellectual life of the community as well. Henry Thoreau hardly needed to leave Concord to see the world. Staying home in Concord meant the world came to him. A Harvard Portrait. There was one thing Henry Thoreau could not get in Concord, however, a college degree. It was not immediately obvious that he needed one. The family considered apprenticing him to a cabinet maker, a logical choice, given he liked to work with his hands. But his aptitude for Phineas Allen's bookish curriculum opened up a new possibility. Cynthia was proud and ambitious for her boys and determined to send at least one of them to Harvard, where her father, Asa Dunbar, had launched his career. In the end, Phineas Allen would, in the quaint phrase of the time, offer for admission to Harvard not her lively and charismatic elder son, but the quiet and studious Henry. On August 30,
deep breath in and pay attention to the way your body moves as you do. Does your abdomen extend? Your chest? Hold that breath for 4 seconds. 1, 2, 3, 4. Now let it out and follow that breath out of your lungs until it's completely gone. Now breathe normally. That act of breathing deeply, of paying attention to your breath and your body as you do, that was an exercise in mindfulness meditation. Mindfulness is a practice that has been known to help with anxiety, depression, even PTSD. In 2012, a Harvard study discovered that subjects who had meditated in the past, as you just did, experienced changes in brain activity, specifically decreased activity in the amygdala, the part of the brain that experiences and regulates emotion, including your stress response, that is sustained even when they're not meditating. In other words, meditating mindfully for just a couple minutes a day could help you to feel way better in the long term. So, give mindfulness meditation a try and see if it works for you. This message has been brought to you by your mega mindful DJs here at WRUV Burlington.
That's right, this is WRUV FM Burlington. This is the DJ known as DJ Not Ted. I'm not playing electronic music this time. As you can tell, I'm doing some educational content around sociability and social capital. What you were just listening to was an excerpt from Henry David Thoreau, A Life, basically covering some initial, his earlier life, talking about the Lyceum movement, which is the namesake of the potential show that I have coming forward. Is going to be probably the next hour is going to be pretty much covering his life and the people that had effect in his life, the social organizations that he was involved with heavily. So kind of the idea of how what I've been setting up for the last hour is like, hey, this sociability, here's some of the positive effects upon your health. It's not just it's just hanging out with friends. It's really something that's essential to human health. After Henry David Thoreau, we're going to be covering another book that kind of goes a little more into the science and the brain science that's involved with it. But for now, kind of Henry David Thoreau, I think, is a counter narrative to someone who you assume is a hermit, someone who is socially isolated, how rich his social life was and how it affected his life going and his art and his community. So that's kind of important. As a person who's an introvert myself, and have found community, which including this radio station, something you should, in my opinion, something you should reach out to yourself. There's plenty. Burlington, if one thing that Burlington has is nonprofit community groups or places you can hang out, there is a ton of them. And I've lived in every place from Berlin to London to other places for per capita. Definitely Burlington has certain things positively going for them. So with my opinion out there, we're going to get right back into Henry David Thoreau. As always, you can call 656-4399. You have any comments about the content at all? I can maybe even relay it on air if you want. Or if you want to chat about it, that's great. So I'll get right back into it. This is pretty much going to be for the hour. I might cut in from here to there to maybe make some disagreements or some notes about the stuff we're going through. But for the most part, I think it's pretty much going to be excerpts from this novel. So keep on listening to your better alternative, WRUV FM Burlington.
1833. A week after his entrance exams, rose early in the morning to take the stage to Cambridge. The carriage rattled over the Lexington Hills, past the cattle market at Porter Square, and down a solitary country road till the college buildings came in sight, gray with age, but the yard gay with students and the life of the opening term. Once he arrived at the back entrance, Thoreau carried his few possessions to Red Brick Hollis Hall, where he roomed with his academy classmate, Charles Stearns Wheeler, the ruddy-cheeked son of a Lincoln farmer. It was a good match. Under Wheeler's quiet and studious good cheer was an intellect burning with high ambition. Their uncarpeted room lacked all the comforts of home. The only furnishings were a pine bedstead, a washstand, washbowl, and pail, a table and two plain chairs, a lamp, and perhaps a desk. Students' rooms were heated by an open wood fire and an old cannonball, which, on cold days, was cooked red-hot and set on a skillet or stand, and on warm nights was occasionally encouraged to roll down the stairs, carefully timed so as to bisect a proctor's night's sleep. Students made their own fires, drew their own water, and polished their own boots, unless they could afford the extra dollars to hire a bootblack. Thoreau's stripped-down life at Walden was hardly less luxurious. The day's schedule was rigidly prescribed. Students attended prayer at 6 in the summers, 6:30 in winters, in the unheated college chapel, where faculty overseers noted every absence and infraction. Students who failed to show up in the mandatory black coat were docked points, except, curiously, Thoreau, whose green coat went unpunished. Likely, President Quincy understood that the scholarship boy could afford no other. The day's first recitations followed, then breakfast at the College Commons, where students fueled up on hot rolls, butter, and coffee, supplemented perhaps by a slice of yesterday's meat pinned by a fork to the underside of the table. Another class came after, followed by a coarse but hearty dinner at 6:30, then afternoon recitations, except on Saturdays. After evening chapel at 6, the students regrouped for a third time to the commons for cold rolls and tea. Then the dormitories rang with laughter and song until the study bell rang curfew at 8. Sundays were work days, with mandatory attendance at morning and evening chapel. Only Saturday afternoons offered a window of freedom to venture off campus, though any who missed evening curfew were threatened with a penalty. Harvard's curriculum was equally rigid. The college was at a low point in its history. Critics fretted that it was falling behind the age, too aristocratic, expensive, and hidebound to attract the really interesting students from the lower and middle classes, and too resistant to reform. It was also very small, just over a dozen professors for 200 students. Numbers fluctuated, but Thoreau's class of 37 never had more than about 50 students. Fortunately, this small set included some lively minds. Richard Henry Dana returned from his 2 years before the mast to join the class of 37, and Horatio Hale left it early to sail with the Wilkes exploring expedition. Charles Dahl would marry Caroline Healy, contributing to a second generation of transcendentalism. Others, such as the poets Jones Very, 36, and James Russell Lowell, 38, overlapped on campus. But class years were strictly segregated. The same few students cycled together for term after term through the same standard courses offered by the same dozen professors, seldom hearing other points of view. Harvard's professors did not socialize with the students, who regarded them as their natural enemies. Should a student seek out a professor for help or advice, it was by night and in secret, for it was a high crime to enter a classroom early or stay late to ask a question. Anyone caught doing that was ostracized as a fish. Thoreau found himself in a barely larger version of the Concord Academy. Youths thrown together, learned from one another, and bonded into a tight cohort. A little world to itself, laced with rivalries and friendships that were remembered, though they might not last, for a lifetime. There were advantages to this. As President Everett remarked, in a mere 4 hours, a young man of any capacity at all could easily accomplish the day's tasks, leaving him lots of time to pursue his own bent unimpeded. For Thoreau, this meant walking off into the countryside to observe birds or hunt for nests and eggs. In a letter from Walden to a young naturalist, he fondly recalled paying his daily respects to a weasel living in a hollow apple tree, and with his friends annually raiding the nest of a long-suffering flicker who steadily supplied the loss like a hen until my chum demolished the hole with a hatchet. It also meant daily trips to Harvard's tremendous library, the best in the nation. On his deathbed, Thoreau would advise Edward Emerson that Harvard's library was perhaps the best gift Harvard had to offer. There, in the stacks, Thoreau began his lifelong habit of keeping a permanent record of his reading by copying extracts into commonplace books. He developed a passion for English poetry from Chaucer to Shakespeare, a mine he worked, as his classmate John Weiss sneered, with a quiet enthusiasm diverting to it hours that should have sparkled with emulation. The man who truly introduced Thoreau to science was not a professor at all, but the college's shy and modest librarian, beloved by generations of students. Thaddeus William Harris. When Harvard had an open position in natural history but no funds to hire anyone, Harris agreed to cover the required course in natural history, dutifully drilling his students in Harvard's outdated textbooks. But Harris's passion for natural history was real, and he was building one of the best insect collections in America. In May 1837, he joined forces with Thoreau and friends to found Harvard's Natural History Society, leading them on field excursions around Cambridge in pursuit of plants, birds, and insects. Students long recalled Harris's beauty-loving soul, his enthusiasm at their discoveries as if he had never seen the like before, and his willingness to lend books and help with a kindness and patience beyond praise. One student recalled how every spring Harris's eyes would kindle over a plain little orchid that grew in a certain field near the observatory. He led their annual quest for it with an enthusiasm that cast the Holy Grail itself into significance. Thoreau's rambles to flickers' nests and weasel dens were thus not lonely escapes from society, but expressions of shared passion and mutual instruction amid a close circle of friends. Harris himself would remain Thoreau's friend and mentor until his death in 1856. Henry arrived just in time to help dedicate the new revolutionary monument on the 4th of July. After a dozen years of debate, everyone had agreed to Reverend Ripley's proposal that a granite obelisk be erected behind his old manse. On that hot afternoon, Henry Thoreau joined the long procession up Monument Street to the site of the Old North Bridge, where 300 men, women, and children gathered on the grass in the sun. The trees that would turn the bleak road into a shady lane had yet to be planted, to hear prayers and a speech by Samuel Hoare, and to sing in chorus Emerson's Concord hymn. In old age, John S. Keyes still remembered the last stanza's invocation of the heroes who dared to die or leave their children free. The last word, free, must have stayed in Henry's mind as well, for he opened his address by invoking it as the keynote of the modern epic. Perfect freedom. Freedom of thought and action. This was indeed his summer of perfect freedom. After the 4th of July, he and Wheeler moved into a cabin Wheeler had built the summer before, perhaps with Thoreau's help, on his family's property on Flint's, or Sandy Pond. For 6 weeks, the two friends loafed by the shore, reading, writing, and dreaming aloud, while the leaves rustled overhead and the summer sun sparkled off the broad lake waters all around, walking to the family farmhouse for their meals. Wheeler brought their other college friends to this cabin, too. The following summer, one would vow there, in this beautiful and secluded spot, in communion with nature and her God, to forsake all lower ambitions and to devote himself to his service. One could say that Henry Thoreau made a similar vow. His experiment at Walden Pond had its origin here, in these weeks spent living and writing with Charles Stearns Wheeler. Henry's immediate concern was earning a living. His commencement speech may have prophesied the one-day work week, but the new graduates still had to work 6 days a week, like everyone else. But unlike his friends, forced by the panic of 1837 to scramble for jobs, he walked into one of the best, teacher of Concord's Center Grammar School, with 90 students and an annual salary of $500, making him one of the hardest-working and best-paid school teachers in town. On Wednesday, September 6th, a week after skipping Emerson's address to American educators, Henry Thoreau entered the classroom. He almost certainly planned to stay for some years, for he saw education as democracy's highest civic calling, a calling reflected in the building itself, an ornate two-story brick schoolhouse in the town center. Through its elaborate portico, Thoreau entered an amphitheater-shaped classroom, sat at his desk, and watched the children of storekeepers, bank directors, lawyers, farmers, millers, carriage makers, and cobblers file through the back door and take their seats, boys on one side, girls on the other. He was to teach them how to read and speak well, write correctly, calculate sums, grasp a little geography, history, natural philosophy, even how to carve barnyard goose quills into writing instruments that served for a page or two before needing repair. His classroom was well equipped. Blackboards, spelling cards, celestial and terrestrial globes, world maps, and wall posters outlining rules of grammar. Pupils worked at their desks, grouped by age and studies, while small groups came forward to review their lessons. In the decade since Thoreau had attended this same school, educational reforms led in part by Edward Jarvis, his former teacher, called for teaching through example and appeals to moral elevation rather than corporal punishment. Thoreau made clear when he was hired that he would not flog his students for disobedience, but talk morals as a punishment instead. But unfortunately, the reformers had moved on, and by 1837, the Concord School Committee had shrunk to three of its most conservative members. One of them, Barzilai Frost, had tutored Thoreau at Harvard and likely approved of his teaching methods. But Deacon Nehemiah Ball did not. The committee's senior member and a formidable presence in town governance, Ball stopped by late in Thoreau's second week to judge the new schoolmaster's conduct. As the story goes, Deacon Ball sat through one session with increasing disapproval, waiting for corporal chastisement, the cornerstone of a sound education. When Thoreau failed to comply, the deacon took him to task. The teacher must flog, or the school would spoil. What Thoreau did changed his life forever. He couldn't actually flog anyone. He didn't even own a cowhide, but he did possess a ferule. And that afternoon, he used it. Accounts vary. Some said he struck one or two students. Some said as many as 13. Only two are recorded. Eliza Jane Durant, the Thoreau family's maidservant, who left their employ soon after, and Daniel F. Potter, who vividly recalled the thrashing and declared as an old man, "It's smart still." He was 10, and he'd just come from a district school where he'd been taught to put his book away, fold his arms, and sit quietly when finished with his lesson. To his astonishment, Thoreau called him up and feruled him for putting away his book and doing nothing. "I was so mad that I said to myself, when I'm grown up, I'll whip you for this, old feller." "But," chuckled Potter, "I never saw the day I wanted to do it." Why, Henry Thoreau was the kindest-hearted of men. So perhaps it was only the two, Jane and Daniel, one girl and one boy. But that was enough. That evening, having completed his act of uncivil obedience, Thoreau went before Deacon Ball and resigned. Next day he returned to tell his students that punishing with force went against his conscience. He wouldn't keep school any longer, if that was the way he had to do it. Thus, 10 days after it began, Thoreau's career as a public school teacher was over. The annoyed school committee hired his friend William Allen in his place, and the term resumed almost immediately. The very evening of his triumphant American Scholar address, the Emersons returned to Concord with a virtual university in their train, who all stayed the night for a huge party the next day, the gala day when the small Transcendentalist circle opened at last to friends and sympathizers, including women. Margaret Fuller and Elizabeth Peabody were there, as were Thoreau's neighbors, Elizabeth Hoare and Sarah Alden Ripley. But Henry Thoreau was not there. In a coincidence that must have felt like destiny, he found himself neighbored by a virtual force of nature. But he would gain entrance, not as a local boy, son of a pencil maker whose mother kept a boarding house, but only as Emerson's intellectual equal, and that must be by Emerson's invitation. The invitation was not long in coming. Emerson opened his Human Culture Lecture Series in Boston on December 6, 1837, and gave his young neighbor tickets. Thoreau walked the 19 miles to Boston's impressive Masonic Temple, where he heard Emerson sorrow in words that echoed Thoreau's own commencement speech, to see men blind to a beauty that is beaming on every side of them. The student who loved mathematics and read through stacks of old English poetry heard Emerson ask, "Cannot a man know the mathematics and love Shakespeare also?" And the boy who dreamed of Walden Pond heard Emerson declare that culture in the high sense turned to nature to awaken humankind, not to the trimming and turfing of gardens, but wild nature, the true harmony of the unshorn landscape, with horrid thickets, wide morasses, bald mountains, and the balance of the land and sea. Thoreau was hooked. And now, at last, so was Emerson. Someone told him that his young neighbor had walked all the way to Boston to hear him speak. Emerson's response was to invite Thoreau to his home, where he was giving private readings of these same lectures to family and close friends. By February 1838, Thoreau and Emerson were companions. "I delight much in my young friend, who seems to have as free and erect a mind as any I have ever met," wrote Emerson. Thoreau made the solitary afternoon sunny with his simplicity and clear perception. "Everything that boy says makes merry with society, though nothing can be graver than his meaning, for he is spiced throughout with rebellion." By April they were taking walks together, and by July Thoreau's transformation was complete. At least, according to James Russell Lowell, whom Harvard had suspended and sent to Concord to rusticate for a spell. The Thoreau School. By May 17th, 1838, Thoreau was back home, still jobless. He'd been either a month too late or 3 months too early. After spinning plans all spring to leave Concord, perhaps for far away and perhaps for good, in the end, he stayed home. Ellery Channing told a family story of a youthful Henry asking his mother which profession to choose, whereupon Cynthia replied, "You can buckle on your knapsack and roam abroad to seek your fortune." As Henry's eyes watered and tears rolled down his cheeks, Helen put her arm around him, kissed him, and said, "No, Henry, you shall not go. You shall stay at home and live with us," which was, for the time being, exactly what he did. In mid-June 1838, Henry Thoreau opened a school of his own, right in the Parkman House. The solution to Henry's travail seemed to unfold like magic. Soon he had 4 students, with another engaged, and was keeping school hours, classes from 8 to 12, a break for lunch, then 2 to 4 in the afternoon, followed by some reading in Greek or English, or, for variety, a stroll in the fields. When the schoolmaster of Concord Academy resigned, the trustees hired Thoreau as the new academy instructor. By September 15th, he was announcing openings in Concord's 2 newspapers for a limited number of pupils of both sexes for instruction in the usual English branches and preparation for college, $6 per quarter. When enrollments got off to a slow start, his family grew worried. Early in October, at Helen's and John's urging, Henry inquired into an opening in Taunton, admitting his present school was not sufficiently lucrative. But his pupils' fathers, Samuel Hoare, John Keyes, the lawyer Nathan Brooks, were prominent men in Concord, and word was spreading. Enrollment grew. By the end of winter quarter, the academy required a second teacher, and on February 9th, John joined his younger brother. As senior teacher, John took the title preceptor, with Henry assisting him in the classical department. Under the Thoreau brothers, Concord Academy soon reached capacity with 25 students. Henry was now free to put his liberating educational principles into practice, and the Thoreau School became one of the most important of the nation's early educational experiments, combining intellectual rigor and a demanding curriculum with the revolutionary transcendentalist notion of culture. Joining this revolution meant one's own education would never end. One should find discussion groups and forge networks to explore and share new thought, such as the twice-monthly teachers' meetings Thoreau attended at Emerson's home. Third, it took real courage to break with generations of convention and ignite students' love of learning. As Emerson warned, the true teacher could not instruct, but only provoke. The actual learning was in the hands of the students themselves. There were few guidebooks to this revolution in education, but Thoreau owned the best. Record of a School, Elizabeth Peabody's account of Bronson Alcott's innovative Temple School in Boston, which Peabody helped Alcott found in 1834. She, too, became a great educational reformer, introducing American readers to the progressive European educators, Pestalozzi and De Gerando, popularizing the radical European idea of the kindergarten and opening a Boston bookstore to help spread transcendentalism to the world and introduce radical books and journals to America. When he visited Thoreau at Walden Pond years later, his former teacher asked what use he'd found his school studies in life. Frisbee Hoare, too, counted him a lifelong friend who never ceased to teach, even after he'd left the classroom. Thoreau had written to Brownson that the classroom should never be separate from the street, and the greatest success of the Thoreau School was the brothers' ability to integrate the school with their community. Why, wondered Thoreau, should we leave off our education when we begin to be men and women? It is time that villages were universities. Uncommon schools where citizens could pursue liberal studies for the rest of their lives, banding together to fund the arts and learning, to make not a village with a few noblemen, but noble villages of men. A classroom so open that everyone would be welcome. It was a goal he would never surrender. There is no remedy for love, but to love more. In 1839, Henry Thoreau's life blossomed. He rose to a position of standing and honor in his community. He went on to the adventure of a lifetime. He began polishing poems and essays for the Transcendentalists' new literary journal, and to top it all off, he fell in love. Twice. Teaching at the Concord Academy did more than give Thoreau a respectable job. It put him at the center of Concord's cultural life, as Phineas Allen had been a decade before. At the first meeting of the Concord Lyceum's new season, Thoreau was elected secretary, and thereafter he proudly recorded Lyceum proceedings in his finest handwriting. When one of the Lyceum curators resigned, Thoreau was elected to fill his place, too. This meant helping to arrange 25 lectures over the six-month season, choosing speakers, writing letters persuading them to come, handling schedule and travel arrangements, securing payments, and returning forgotten articles, all on a tight budget. This was genuine service, the kind that earned Thoreau the right to suggest, in Walden, that villages could indeed become universities. Lyceum members showed their appreciation by re-electing him to double duty for a second year. They tried to re-elect him for a third year as curator, but, overwhelmed, Thoreau begged off, only to be re-elected again 2 years later, in November 1842, over his protests. Altogether, Thoreau's social world was exploding. He dropped by the Emersons every few days to greet their constant stream of visitors, including, about this time, Margaret Fuller and Bronson Alcott. They'd built the Musketaquid that spring, roomy and strong, to take a trip together down the Concord River and up the Merrimack to the White Mountains, climb Mount Washington, then float home. To celebrate, the brothers held a melon party for the entire neighborhood. Keyes got the grand tour of all the minutiae of packing and affirmed Henry had all things arranged prime and will have a glorious time if he is fortunate enough to have good weather. After admiring the table spread, in the very handsomest style with all kinds and qualities of melons, Keyes and the fellows attacked them furiously until, what with wine and all, he had quite as much as he could carry home. Late summer melon parties became a Thoreau tradition. After another 1 year later, Elizabeth Hoare reported that Henry had adorned the table with sunflowers, corn stalks, beet leaves, and squash blossoms. There were 46 melons, 15 different kinds, and apples, all the production of his own garden. To her amusement, Cynthia, having spread it around town that Henry detested parties, felt she had to apologize when he threw one himself. Saturday morning, August 31st, dawned gloomy and drizzly. But as the skies cleared into a mild summer afternoon, the brothers unchained their boat from the wild apple tree and shoved off into the open waters of the Concord River. The Musketaquid was well loaded with potatoes, melons, and other supplies. Two masts, one doubling as a tent pole, a cotton tent that doubled as a sail, and a buffalo hide to sleep on. The gaily painted boat, green below with a border of blue above, made a picturesque sight for the family and friends gathered on shore to see them off, and as the brothers raised their guns and fired a farewell volley, the hills rang with echoes. As they floated past the Old North Bridge battleground, they meditated on the din of war. And at the Great Meadows, when they spotted a rare and spectacular hibiscus in bloom, they hailed a farmer and gave him a blossom with instructions to carry it to church on the morrow for their botanist friend, Prudence Ward. They made 7 miles that day, pitching their tent on a patch of high ground near Billerica, picking huckleberries for their supper of bread and sugar, then sipping hot cocoa made with river water while they watched their shadows lengthen and the sun set. Sunday morning, their campfire smoke mingled with the thick morning fog which had burned off by the time they reached the Middlesex Canal. They walked the towpath, drawing their boat behind under the censorious gaze of Sunday churchgoers. After being locked to the swift Merrimack, they turned upriver, nooning in the shade near Chelmsford, where they gathered wild plums. Then, passing Wickasuck Island, the lost home of the Penacook Indians, where they refused a ride to 2 lost men anxious to get to Nashua. At Tingsboro they made camp by twilight under an oak by the stream, and all night they drowsed while the river eddied, and Irish railroad workers kept them awake with boisterous sport. That night, Henry reported, one sailor was beset in his dreams by the evil destinies, while the other passed a serene and even ambrosial or immortal night. Awakening the next morning to soothe and reassure with his good cheer. Need we guess which was which? Monday, September 2nd, they navigated the busy ferry passage as their countrymen stirred about their work week. One brother brought the boat around the river's lazy oxbow curves, while the other cut across, collecting well water and reports of the countryside. They hailed a canal boat, tied up alongside, and floated in company, chatting with the boatmen. Later, they stopped to explore an ancient Indian home site, exposed when fishermen had broken the bank pulling out the brush. The sand had blown ashore, creating a pocket desert. As they passed Nashua's falls and factories, they cast longing eyes at the blue heights of Wachusett and Monadnock beyond, but stayed riverbound, camping near Nashville, New Hampshire, under a pine wood by a deep ravine, where they fell asleep listening to a distant drummer practice for a muster of country militia. By 3 o'clock a.m. they were underway again, and by dawn they had been rowing for hours past woods, pastures, and fields of corn, potatoes, rye, oats, and English hay. At the locks around Cromwell's Falls, the Nissankeag of the Indians, they picked up arrowheads on the bank while waiting their turn, listening to the lock tenders' stories of buried treasure and witnessing the end of an era. Soon the railroad, not the canals, would carry the region's freight. That night, the brothers reached the limit of their river journey, pitching their tents just below Hookset Pinnacle, exactly where a party of Penobscot Indians had camped a few summers before. John went off to find a farmhouse for provisions and returned with young Nathan Mitchell, the farmer's boy, who longed to join them. "Come along," they said, but Father said no, then compensated with a tour of his farm and permission to store their gear in his barn. That night, Henry dreamed of a difference with a friend that was, in dream space, resolved, leaving him unspeakably soothed and rejoiced. Next morning, September 5th, dawned the ominous sound of raindrops on their cotton rooftop. They walked 10 miles through the rain to Concord, New Hampshire. New Concord, They joked with the friends who put them up for the night, where they caught the morning stage to Plymouth on the verge of the White Mountains. From there, it was 15 miles up Pemigewasset Valley to James Tilton's Inn in Thornton. The next day, the 7th, they walked through Peeling, now Woodstock, and Lincoln to Franconia to see the Notch and the famous Old Man of the Mountain, a craggy formation now lost in a rockfall. On the 8th, they walked to Crawford House, from where they set off next morning to explore the mountains, reaching the summit of Mount Washington the next day. Back at the bottom, they caught the stage to Conway, and for 2 days retraced their steps to the campsite in Hooksett, which they reached on September 12th, a week to the day after they stored their gear in Mitchell's barn. They didn't linger. After packing up their boat and purchasing young Nathan's prize watermelon, the largest on the farm, for ballast, they set off homeward. Thanks to the strong current and friendly winds, they made it all the way downstream to an island north of Merrimack, New Hampshire, where they pitched their tent for the last time. Long before daybreak on their last day together, Friday, September 13th, the brothers lay awake listening to a fresh autumn wind rustle the leaves overhead. The season had turned in the night. "We had gone to bed in summer," wrote Henry years later, "and we awoke in autumn." It was 50 miles to Concord, but with the north wind at their backs, they made the distance in a day, flying down the Merrimack past the sites of their upward journey, watching them fade one after another into memory. At noon, their old friend, the lock tender, let them back into the Middlesex Canal, and they rowed up the gentle Concord River, a long pull in a dreamy mood through sunset into darkness until, far in the evening, our boat was grating against the bulrushes of its native port, and its keel recognized the Concord mud. The Thoreau brothers leaped out and fastened the Musketaquid to the wild apple tree. They were home. By July, with the issue in print, Emerson's own uncanny river god had moved back to the alcove at the top of the stairs, once again serving as handyman, and now the Dials' editorial assistant as well. This put Thoreau back at the heart of Emerson's growing circle of friends and associates. Indeed, so many visitors took to dropping by that the Emerson's cook threatened to post a sign on the front gate, "This house is not a hotel." Their daughter Ellen remembered how in those transcendental times, all sorts of visitors with new ideas began to come to the house. The men who thought money was the root of all evil, the vegetarians, the sons of nature who did not believe in razors nor in tailors, the philosophers and all sorts of come-outers. Hawthorne chuckled to see how Emerson conjured up such hobgoblins of flesh and blood who were drawn to his intellectual fire as a beacon burning on a hilltop. Bats and owls, and the whole host of nightbirds, which flapped their dusky wings against the gazer's eyes, and sometimes were mistaken for fowls of angelic feather. Never, he concluded hilariously, was a poor little country village infested with such a variety of queer, strangely dressed, oddly behaved mortals. One of them, arguably, was Hawthorne himself. After heaving manure for 8 months at Brook Farm, he'd concluded to resume a more ordinary relation to society. Just as he was looking for a place to bring his bride-to-be, Sophia Peabody, the Reverend Ezra Ripley passed on to his heavenly reward, leaving the old manse open. Hawthorne signed the lease, and by June 1842, Cynthia Thoreau and Elizabeth Hoare had made the old gray parsonage all new and bright again as a toy for the newlyweds. By then, Henry was strong enough to help Jack Garrison's son, John, work up some land alongside the avenue to the manse, planting it with beans, peas, cabbages, and squash, both summer and winter, as his wedding gift to Nathaniel and Sophia. They moved into the old manse on July 9, 1842, the afternoon of their wedding day. Soon afterward, Emerson and Thoreau paid their formal call. It was awkward. Three great writers, sitting bolt upright, each struggling to break the silence with something profound. But when Thoreau returned alone, he and Hawthorne found their friendship growing. Hawthorne, wrapped in his cloak, moving, like a self-impelled Greek statue, stately and grave, and Emerson, evidently too weary to hold himself erect, pitching head foremost, half-lying on the air. Twice the Hawthornes would move away from Concord, and both times on their return, Nathaniel and Henry would renew their friendship. When they laughed together, said Channing, the operation was sufficient to split a pitcher. Another young idealist drawn to Emerson, that prime minister of the spirit, was Margaret Fuller's younger brother, Richard. Fuller's tutorials in Concord gained him midterm admission to Harvard, and in July 1843, eager for a summer break, he walked from Cambridge to Emerson's house. After being roundly examined, to see if I yet surrendered to imagination, the next morning he and Thoreau shouldered knapsacks and set off for Mount Wachusett, 30 miles away on the western horizon. They planned it as a literary excursion. Richard kept a running record of his thoughts, and Henry's notes grew into his next original essay, A Walk to Wachusett. From childhood on, Thoreau's eyes had rested on the dim blue outline of Wachusett. He even addressed a poem to the mountain, the one Margaret Fuller had so firmly rejected. Now, this walk with her brother would be itself a form of composition, using the approach she had recommended. Nature will not be yours, she had said, until you have been more hers. Seek the lotus and take the draught of rapture. After setting out in the cool dawn twilight, they paused to cut stout walking sticks, then again to chat with mowers in the meadows. As they walked on westward, Thoreau's excitement grew at the locals, truer and wilder pronunciation, not Waytatic, Wachusett, but Wartatic, Wachusett. What a letdown that evening when, at that wild western inn, the innkeeper handed them a copy of the Concord newspaper. Next morning they left, in the gray twilight, to hike the remaining 4 miles to the mountain's base. As they ascended, the trees got smaller, then vanished altogether on the summit. Where, on the ruins of an old observation tower, they read Virgil and Wordsworth, and ate wild blueberries washed down with fresh milk from a farm below. From on high they watched the sun set, and night creep over the land until the sun's rays fell on us two alone, of all New England men. As the moon rose, they kindled their campfire, visible for 30 miles around, and at dawn the whole of Massachusetts lay spread out before us in its length and breadth, like a map. At noon they descended eastward into the dusty abodes of men, stopping at Harvard Village to reflect on the sunset and spend the night. Next morning they parted, Henry for Concord, and Richard to join his family. Emerson advanced him $20 for supplies and new clothes, and another $7.
listen to WREV FM Burlington. DJ Nantet, I cut in a little bit just to play some music to break up the story a little bit. We'll get right back to Henry David Thoreau. Number here is 656-4399. It's 3:55, almost 3:56. So we're going to be playing a public service announcement, and then we'll get back into the final three parts of the condensed version of Henry David Thoreau, A Life. Hopefully you're having a good time out there. Just to give you an idea, what we've been playing for the last bit is pretty much stuff about sociology, social capital, and history. A little bit of history of Henry David Thoreau and his life. So I'll play you a public service announcement, and we'll get right back into it. 5 o'clock hour, you'll be getting the news and weather, so look forward to that. Right now, what you're listening to in the background is Music for Airports by Brian Eno, who happens to be my favorite artist pretty much of all time. And this is track one from that album. Stay tuned. You can also chat me, I guess. I've totally forgot this a chat thing. You can go to the webpage, wrev.org, typey-type with some letters into the computer and be like, yo, hey. And if the comments are relevant to what I'm playing, I might give a shout-out or say what you said, as long as it's nice. No swear words. We don't like swear words here. I mean, I don't mind swear words. It's FCC, guys. I can't read swear words.
Live more safely. Vaccines with a booster help prevent hospitalization and death. Having good inside air circulation from a HEPA filter or open windows really matters. It isn't easily transmitted on surfaces, so that whole sanitizing your groceries thing isn't a thing. Most importantly, wearing a good-fitting, high-quality mask when inside with others or in large crowds can be a game changer. Now is the time to toss those old cotton masks from 2020 and upgrade your face wear. Consider getting the readily available KN95 or N95 masks. These masks are 95% effective in filtering out big and little airborne particles. Cotton masks and even surgical masks are too loose-fitting and don't provide enough reliable protection. Visit projectn95.org for more information on where you can find non-counterfeit KN95 or N95 masks. This message is brought to you by the Always Masked Up DJs at WRUV FM Burlington.
Hey, I'm back. I'm actually not wearing a mask right now because I'm by myself in the on-air booth. Anyway, hey, so let's get right back into Henry David Thoreau and keep it real, guys.
Emerson advanced him $20 for supplies and new clothes, and another $7 for traveling expenses. He wrote William with a trace of anxiety, "And now goes our brave youth into the new house, the new connection, the new city. I am sure no truer and no purer person lives in wide New York, though he might pester one with some accidental crotchets and perhaps a village exaggeration of the value of facts. As for cultivating a literary career, here, too, Thoreau started off with a good will. Emerson was eager for him to meet Henry James, an independent, right-minded man, and the best apple on the tree, assuring James that once he got past Thoreau's village pedantry and tediousness of facts, he would find a profound mind and a person of true magnanimity. James reached out immediately with a warm invitation, and as soon as he was well enough, Thoreau visited his home on Washington Square, where he perhaps looked in on the newborn Henry James, Jr., the future novelist, and his infant brother William, the future philosopher. For the first time,